Thank you very much, Murray, for so magnificently fulfilling our expectation that the legal advisor to the UK Parliament's Joint Committee on Human Rights would have extraordinarily valuable information and insights and experience to share with us today. I think it is valuable to remind us that democracies, and I think perhaps ours even more than the UK's, is ultimately an exercise in checks and balances. And in Australia, we're accustomed to that. Each of the three branches of government plays a role in checking and balancing the powers of the other to have a well-functioning democracy. Some of you will know that not long ago I was a member of the judicial branch rather than the executive branch of government. And I think it is worth occasionally exploring why it is that judges are not elected. It's put forward almost as a criticism that judges are unelected. It is, of course, the great strength of the judiciary that it's unelected, because it is not subjected to the pressures that others, particularly those who have to be interviewed on national television nightly, are under, and who face election every now and again are under. They have a capacity to distance themselves from incidents of the moment and pressures of the moment to take a more considered view on issues. And we're all aware, if you look at history of this country and others, that there are times when the power of a majority can be abused. We don't need to identify here instances of that. We know of that. And therefore a power for someone to say, well, let's stop now. We're not being entirely rational now. We feel threatened. We feel pressure. We think the nation is facing threat. To analyse in a more principled way what is the appropriate approach can be a very valuable insight in a democracy where views can be exchanged between a judiciary, an executive branch and a legislative branch of government. And that, I think, is one of the valuable things that declarations of incompatibility that would be supported by a reasoned judgment, one of the reasons that would be valuable to a national discussion about human rights that would involve not only the branches of government but the community as well. So I think, although that expands on what Murray had to say and puts it perhaps slightly more into the Australian context, I think it's very valuable for you to remind us about this checks and balances aspect of a well-functioning democracy. And I'd like to stress, although, the value of what is happening in committees being extremely public in the way that Murray has identified. And friends of mine in the UK have said there have been instances where it was civil society that was able to identify potential human rights implications of legislation that neither the executive branch introducing the legislation nor committees to the legislative branch had identified. And lawyers understand about that, and I think people understand about that. You often don't see things if you look at them at the more theoretical level. But if you're given the chance to think, how would this impact on me, because this is my life, this is my experience, or this is what I want to do, then people suddenly see, well, this would stand in my way. And so I think the chance for civil society generally to be involved, whether it's because any committee we might have does have a very open website, or because parliamentary debates are available to be watched on the television or otherwise accessed by people who are interested, I think public involvement in any process of this kind is likely to prove critical. There are lots of other things I could say, but I know you didn't come today to talk to me. So let's see if there are comments or observations or questions that any member of the audience would like to make as a contribution to today's seminar. Yes, Professor.
Spencer Zivchak from the Australian Catholic University. Murray, if I could take off from where Cathy has just led us and ask you to address the second part of the equation, that is the judicial part of the equation. I wonder how you would respond to an argument which is developing some force in Australia, particularly amongst those who oppose a charter, to the effect that this is exactly what we need. We need a terrific parliamentary committee to report to the parliament about the compatibility of laws with broadly stated human rights principles. And if we've got that and improve question time and do this, that and the other, we can set the courts aside. there's really no need for them. So if you could talk a little bit about how you see the role of the courts in this process of checks and balances, I'd appreciate it.
Okay, so it's a very good and very fair question. I suppose the first thing I would do is point to the 17 declarations of incompatibility, some of which are in respect of provisions. Am I audible at the back with this microphone? Which post-date the Human Rights Act. They're not all about old statutory provisions. So there are a growing list of examples of bills which have been passed by Parliament in the face of advice from the Joint Committee on Human Rights, where the government hasn't accepted the advice of the Joint Committee on Human Rights, and courts have then subsequently found the legislation to be incompatible. So I think that's the most compelling argument, that you need both. It's not enough just to have a good functioning committee. Now, of course, one would hope that in the long run, a good functioning committee and a proper commitment and all the sorts of things that I've mentioned in the sort of wish list would reduce the number of times that courts would be required. But I don't think, I think the reality of politics is such that one can't eliminate the need for courts to be there in the background. But I think it's what is extremely important, I think, is that when courts are considering human rights compatibility questions which have already been considered by Parliament, the fact that Parliament has already had a lively and well-informed and properly advised debate on human rights issues ought to inform the court's readiness to intervene. And we see this in European Court of Human Rights cases, where they're much more ready to interfere with, for example, blanket bans on prisoner voting from the UK, where there's never really been a proper parliamentary debate. They're much more ready to intervene. If there is proper parliamentary debate, which has been properly informed and it's been conscientiously held on a very divisive issue, courts are, in fact, much more likely to respect, in a genuine sense, the democratic outcome than they are in the absence of that. So I think that's also an argument for having both. But I think one does need both.
Belinda Smith from the University of Sydney, and I think the question leads on quite well from this. I agree that there does seem to be this dichotomisation between judicial models and legislative models, and this great fear of the judiciary taking on this undemocratic position. And I just wonder, I don't know much about the UK position other than what you've told us today, I just wonder whether it's exacerbated by a narrow understanding of what the judiciary does. And your response now sort of confirms that maybe it is, because I wonder whether the judiciary, our view of the judiciary is that they just make final substantive decisions about yes and no human rights compatibility, or whether they do what you just suggest they do, which is similar to the committee, which is send things back with guidance as to why the process was poor or the information was poor, or the, you know, to encourage greater, better informed deliberations, which is a more legitimate role for our courts in some ways. They're not usurping Parliament in terms of making value judgments about how these human rights operate in action. In some ways, they're guiding, or they may be guiding, Parliament and parliamentarians to have a better debate about this, which is what you just suggested. But could you give us a little bit more information about those declarations and the reasoning that they give? You just implied that they deferred when there was good debate and they were more likely to intervene when there was poor process. Is that typical?
There isn't. It's really still too early to say what's typical. Although we're 8 years down the road from it coming into force, the degree of judges sort of embracing the Human Rights Act varies enormously. Those declarations vary enormously in terms of the courts sort of agonising over whether they should give a declaration of incompatibility or use the interpretive power to avoid giving a declaration, to rewrite the law and so on. So there isn't really a typical case. The number's too small, really, to generalise about. I think you're right that in one sense, the received view amongst the judges is that the compatibility question might be something that Parliament has already decided, but it's a legal question and it's for them. And I think a lot of judges would take that view, that we're the arbiters of compatibility, don't care what Parliament did or what debates they had, we're the ones who decide. And that, so their mindset is that, you know, whatever type of Human Rights Act you've got, it's a sort of judicial supremacy model, really. They are the ultimate arbiters and interpreters of the meaning of the convention rights. I think over time that will be increasingly difficult for them to, a position that's increasingly difficult for them to maintain, as they realise increasingly how human rights courts throughout the world, including the Strasbourg court, in practice actually reason. And the fact is, as we know from Strasbourg jurisprudence, including in many cases involving the UK, that the court will take into account, in deciding whether or not it's going to defer, effectively use the margin of appreciation, or regard itself as legitimately interfering, the extent to which there was democratic, properly informed democratic deliberation and debate. And they are more likely to respect outcomes where there's been that. And we aren't yet anywhere near that in the UK. But I think it's over time much more likely to happen as the courts get more and more familiar with the nature of the adjudicative exercise that they're doing when they're deciding whether a limitation is justified. I don't know whether that answers your question. One other comment on what you say. I suppose I would be wary of what you described as the legitimate judicial process sounded, I appreciate a tricky issue, but it sounded like a purely process-based approach to the course. Maybe I'm mischaracterising what you said. But I think there probably is a more legitimate role for courts in a structure like the Human Rights Act, where they can only give declarations of incompatibility, to also engage in value judgments and not simply look at the process and decide whether the boxes have been ticked and so on and send it back. So with that caveat, I think I agree.
Could I just make a remark about that? And it's in part an advertisement for our next seminar. There's considerable debate in Australia about the extent to which Chapter 3 of the Australian Constitution would allow Australian courts to involve themselves in this process, and we're extremely lucky that the former High Court Judge, Michael McHugh, has agreed to give our next seminar on this topic, and I urge everyone who's interested to come and hear what His Honour has to say. But could I also say that to some extent I think what you identify as being desirable would be very difficult to make work in Australia, because although my personal view is that we can draft an Australian Human Rights Act that allows for declarations of incompatibility, but that's entirely a private view, if one assumes that that's right, we'll still remain with the position that the federal courts in Australia cannot give advisory opinions, and what they're doing will be in the context of inter partes litigation. Now, this brings me back, in a sense, to a theme which I hold very dear to my heart in this whole process, which is education, whether of the community or of each branch of government, is absolutely critical to get what we want. I mean, ultimately, what we want is not just that we have an act or just that we have a constitution, but that we have a nation that respects, understands and promotes human rights. For that reason, I think education at every level is critical, and included in that at the one end is a bureaucracy that will be involved in implementing laws, and whatever happens, I hope that the consultation will lead to greater human rights education throughout this country, in particular for those who are making decisions under laws. But the judiciary cannot be excluded from this issue, and Australia's judiciary doesn't have the benefit that the United Kingdom's judiciary had, which have a long-term experience with Strasbourg jurisprudence. Australia has isolated itself from international jurisprudence on human rights in a way that I think makes the need for judicial education in this country a very critical thing. Now, that leads me circuitously back to what we're already discussing, which is well-reasoned debate in the Parliament informed by a well-informed committee on human rights that ensured that the right issues were debated in the Parliament. Very valuable as material for a court to consider were it to become seized of an inter partes dispute in which a possible outcome could be a declaration of incompatibility. It wouldn't of itself be sufficient, but it would be a good start. And I think judges will appreciate, as I'm sure everyone here does, that where you have rights that are not absolute, there is a judgment to be made. Australian courts, like other courts, are familiar with working in this territory where there is no absolute right decision. But well-reasoned people, you know, right-minded, well-informed, appropriately reasoning, will ultimately realise that there is a margin within which legitimate views can be taken that will all be valid. And that's really what we mean when we talk about the margin of appreciation. For myself, I think Australian courts will be able to grapple with that, but I do think education for them and others is a critical aspect of what we're talking about. Yes, here.
I'm asking you.
Could you give your name, do you mind?
My name is Minna Singh, and I represent United Nations Association and a few more NGOs. my question is that Universal Declaration of Human Rights was passed in 1948, but there was section of our Australians, they were considered non-entity till 1967 when they got right to vote. Where was Parliament, where was judiciary to completely ignore one section of people's human rights? And human rights had been universally supposed to be an authority or enactment. And also I will ask that even now Australia is a colony of Britain. Even Britain did, none of the lawyers in Britain at all pointed out about the injustices done to these indigenous people.
Could I say first, in reference to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Australians, I think nobody doubts that there is a past history and indeed a continuing history of their failing to enjoy the human rights to which all Australians are entitled to the same degree as Australians generally do. 1967 was the year the referendum was passed to allow them to be counted in the census, and also included a special power in the Constitution, the language of which I think is now a matter that people want to reconsider, whether it's, as it has been interpreted, the best wording. But human rights generally have been achieved progressively over time by lots of people. I mean, you and I are both women. We know that the human rights of women are only now starting to be fully recognised in this country and elsewhere. There are stains on our human rights record. I think we recognise that. We're doing what we can to ensure that all Australians enjoy their human rights equally.
No, I don't agree, I'm sorry.
Did you want to make another observation?
Yes. I have been representing Australian women at the United Nations conference. And but any time I spoke about, particularly I'll mention about Iraq war, and I represented the biggest Australian women's organization, NCW. And when it came to our government at that time supporting Bush to go for Iraq war, I stood up in my executive meeting at the NCW and I said it will be very, very wrong to go to war on such flimsy grounds. And I come from a country which has second largest Muslim population. We have lived with Muslims, and Muslim Brotherhood is very strong, I told them. I said that the whole of Muslim world will get on one side. You will not have any face to say that this was a just war. Because in Middle East, this fellow Hussein, against whom they were, he was the only secular person and not fanatically a Muslim state.
I think turn this into a debate about the Iraq
war. Yes, and you know, I was told by the president that you are giving support to the terrorists. And I was demoted from the executive, and I didn't go for meetings anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But these are the way people understand about human rights.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I'm sure you're right about that, and I'm sure you understand that the Australian Human Rights Commission is independent of the Australian government and has on occasions been quite critical of decisions the government has taken. And I commend you on your perspicacity about the initially given reason for the war in Iraq. But perhaps we'll ask Mr. Hunt to answer in response to your initial question.
Yeah, in response to your initial question, I think you very powerfully make the case for better protection of human rights. I mean, it's our experience of history that has persuaded us that there are big gaps in our protections for human rights. That's why we're all striving to find ways to better protect them.
Hi, my name is Sepp Osdowski. I'm from University of Western Sydney, and my congratulations on your address. It was very interesting. I would like to ask you, I'm also interested in the proper role of judiciary in this case, and would like to ask you to compare US and UK systems. In particular, let's imagine for a moment that Guantanamo Bay is British, that you run it. Would your system deliver similar outcomes as the US Supreme Court?
As the Supreme Court did when it asserted jurisdiction over it. Yes, I think I can fairly confidently say our courts would have.
Would it be faster?
If there were an attempt, would it have been faster? it's hard to say. the decision on the measures which the main measures which our government took after 9/11, which fell foul of the Human Rights Act, did take quite a long time to reach the House of Lords. The detention of non-nationals was eventually found to be incompatible with the European Convention in December 2004, which was 3 years after they were enacted. So I'm not sure I can confidently say it would have been quicker. But I'm fairly confident that any attempt to have set up a black hole somewhere on an island would have been treated in the same way as the Supreme Court eventually treated it in America.
Yes, Father Brennan.
Frank Brennan from the committee, and thanks, Murray. We had a great session, our committee and secretariat, this morning with you. Could I invite you to be just a bit stereotypical and simplistic? Of those 17 declarations of incompatibility, how many of those do you think the politicians at the end of the day would have said, thank goodness for the Human Rights Act, we got it wrong and now we've got it right, over against, damn that Human Rights Act, there were good reasons for doing what we did, and if only we could still do that, it would be better. Any idea of how that would stack up?
Numerically, I don't, off the top of my head, I'll have to think about it and get back to you, Frank, but there are certainly cases, including the one I've referred to, the detention of foreign nationals, where a lot of the government would have felt pesky courts and would have probably contemplated whether they should accept the court's interpretation. That one in particular, because that was so core to their response, their counter-terrorism response after 9/11. The fact that on that one they didn't, I think, is very telling and really does set actually the bar afterwards. But I think that probably there are quite a few where I can think of a handful where we, the committee, said this is the compatibility problem, and that has subsequently been upheld in the courts. So they can't really complain about not having been told. And they gave us arguments at the time, which they then used in the courts and lost. But to their credit, they've always then changed the law. And we have had arguments about whether they've gone far enough subsequently in changing the law. We've had arguments in particular about how quickly they've gone about introducing a measure in response. I mean, quite often they could do it much more quickly than they do. Often there are good reasons to need to consult. But I think it's hard on balance to say, but I think the most significant one was the one about the detaining the non-nationals. And I think after that, I think it would be quite difficult. It would take a particularly obstreperous minister to argue within this government, that they shouldn't conform to the declaration.
Yes, here. The microphone's on your other side, yes.
My name's Alex Heron, and I was working for Citizens Advice till recently, which is one of the UK NGOs that's increasingly been using human rights arguments in its advocacy for clients. And one of its particular interests is access to justice, in fact. And I wondered about the 22 cases that were brought or succeeded at first instance. I wondered how many cases had originally perhaps started and failed, and how those have been funded, and whether you think there might be a more satisfactory way of enabling cases to be taken if perhaps that funding was a bit haphazard. I can't remember myself whether it's that the Commission takes some cases or NGOs, but it does seem to me that if the legislative or judicial proceedings are going to be a reality, we also need to think at the same time about how to make those a reality as part of this two-pronged approach.
No, I entirely agree with exactly what you say. And in fact, we are currently scrutinising a coroner's bill, which is before Parliament, which is reforming the law on coroner's inquests. And one of the things which the committee is interested in is, in reality, what access do families have to these procedures if they can't get legal aid to get representation to appear before the inquest. So we've got, on the whole, not bad bill, providing a fairly good investigative scheme for where the European Convention requires official investigations of deaths. But in practice, there's a really serious access question. And that is something which the committee have been interested in a number of different contexts. It's quite tricky to make much progress on, because the government's answer generally in relation to public funding availability for human rights issues is that there's a discretion available on the Lord Chancellor's part in regulations, and it all has to be exercised in individual cases, advised by his public interest advisory panel, as you know. And that, as a process, on the face of it, isn't a bad process. The public interest advisory panel has NGO representatives on it and so on. But there's still a sense in a number of contexts that there still isn't satisfactory access in relation to vindicating human rights claims. So I mean, I agree entirely with you. It's been something which has been hard to do for the committee to do anything about. In terms of when you mentioned the 22, do you mean the number of declarations of incompatibility that there have been? Oh, I see. Well, there are vastly more cases where human rights arguments are made. But the declaration of incompatibility cases are the very small tip of the Human Rights Act caseload where the court has given a declaration. So there are a very much bigger number of cases. They were monitored for a while by the Lord Chancellor's Department, as it then was. But then they no longer are, because I think it's just difficult to keep track. I mean, human rights arguments are made in a large number of cases. But there is a general access problem, but it's one which we're going to have another look at in the context of this coroner's bill. But it's a difficult one to get to make any progress on, to be honest. Sorry, while we're waiting for the next, I should say also, the committee has also been interested in but hasn't yet really done any substantive work on sort of encouraging non-judicial means of resolving human rights problems and informal processes for, and I think there's a lot of work to be done there, because you're quite right that really having just the courts as the only other alternative to the legislative process isn't really very satisfactory. And it's something which the committee's going to be looking at. It's doing a business and human rights inquiry in the summer, and it's going to be looking at non-judicial and non-legal sort of alternative ways of addressing human rights complaints in that context.
Hi, my name's Emma Bull. I'm from the office of Senator Bob Brown in the Federal Parliament. I have just two quick questions. One is about the makeup of the Joint Committee. Is that a cross-party committee, and does someone have the majority, and can you have a dissenting report on that committee? And secondly, whether you've had any success in changing the culture of the public service and the bureaucracy over there to get them to start thinking about the human rights obligations earlier when they start drafting the legislation. And you mentioned that perhaps if they could do a statement of compatibility with the EM that comes through with the bill, that would be quite handy for everyone, and I can see that working quite well over here. Just your thoughts on whether that's changing in the public service.
Sure. On the first question, it's a joint committee of both houses, so we've got six peers and six Commons members. There's no government majority. The chair is a member of the governing party, but obviously not a minister. Ministers can't be members of committees, obviously. There are three Labour Commons members, two Conservative and one Lib Dem Commons members. On the peers side, there's one crossbencher, two Conservatives, two Labour and one Liberal Democrat. So it's quite a wide range of opinion, especially with the crossbencher in there as well. And given that sort of spectrum, surprisingly, they divide very infrequently. They are in principle perfectly entitled to divide. People can record their dissents in the usual way, moving motions to disagree with bits of reports and so on. It has happened occasionally on very particularly divisive issues. It happened in some of the terrorism reports just after the 2005 bombs in London. There was two of the Conservative peers dissented from one aspect of the UK Bill of Rights report about social and economic rights. But generally speaking, they proceed by consensus, and they manage on the whole to agree unanimously their reports. As far as progress is concerned with the executive, I think the honest answer is yes, there has been quite a lot of progress, but it's extremely patchy and rather faltering. We have consistently asked for this dedicated human rights memorandum, which we think isn't a very big ask, because they already have to produce a human rights memorandum, to go to Legislative Procedure Committee when they try and get time for their bill. The department tries to get the cabinet to agree their bill. And we've asked them just to strip out the legally privileged bits of that memorandum and let us see that. So that we're not asking them to create a new document. So it's not really a very big thing to ask. They've consistently said no, I think probably because the quality of those documents is rather variable. But interestingly, in some recent bills, we have some bill teams, the civil servants, have started to provide effectively what we're asking for, either in the form of a separate freestanding letter which they send us when the bill's been published, which is very much like a human rights memorandum which they voluntarily provide, or in very detailed explanatory notes. In the explanatory notes which accompany the bill, there's a human rights section. And one example, the Criminal Justice and Immigration Bill from the last session had an unprecedented number of pages in the explanatory notes analysing the human rights compatibility of the bill. And it turned out, subsequently, it transpired that was because that bill team manager decided to do what we've been asking for. And that's what we'd like to happen across the board. And I think if that did happen, it would make a really very serious difference in terms of the quality of the product.
Can I ask you a very sort of simple question? I mean, looking at human rights, everyone, everywhere, every day, on that level, how does at the end of the day, how do these rights translate to us as individuals? In one sense, if you take the UK, you have a sense of being spied on constantly. It's sort of increased in the last years, I feel, quite strongly. Very recently when there was an activist going to some environmental campaign, the police were outside photographing everybody who went into this meeting. I mean, when you are so intimidated and threatened and you put on the list of extremists for being an activist, how do you really, at the end of the day, translate these acts into your day-to-day life? And this lady talked about conscientious... speaking at a conference, for example, and of course you talked about conscientiousness. How do we deal with that?
At one level, what the committee can do is quite limited, in that all it can do at the end of the day is report to Parliament. So it's for parliamentarians to take up or not take up its reports. But the process of inquiring into these things, which I mentioned, is actually probably as important as the recommendations which are made to Parliament. And to take your example, we've just finished an inquiry into policing and protest. And the very issue you identify was an issue which was identified by witnesses. And we had journalists come and give oral evidence to us about exactly that point, them being intimidated from covering protests because the police were taking photos of them. And we had the police giving evidence in the same session, and we then asked the minister in the later session about what the government was going to do about this. And very interestingly, the minister in the meantime had met with the representative of the journalists to try and address the issue in advance of anything we say in our report. But the issue having been identified by the witnesses to our inquiry, and it was obviously a problem, the government in that instance had decided to take the initiative and actually meet with the journalists in the meantime. Now, we haven't yet reported on that, so I don't know yet what we're going to actually say at the end of the day. But it's an important, I think it's an important example of, you're right, in terms of what does this mean for ordinary people on the ground. That opportunity to come along to a committee, put in written evidence, possibly come and give oral evidence, does give an opportunity to engage in a process where they might actually influence an outcome. And hopefully there will be some change in the practice which has been complained of there.
Thank you. I wonder if I might presume to close the seminar by asking a question of my own, which is that there is obviously a full range of protections that Australia or any other country could adopt to protect human rights in its country. And we've tended to look most carefully at legislative or statutory protection and constitutional or entrenched protection. But it's obvious from what you say that a parliamentary standing committee on human rights has a value of its own in protecting human rights, and would no doubt be a valuable addition to Australia's parliamentary procedures. But to what extent do you think the capacity of the committee that you advise to achieve outcomes, both within the parliament and outside, is enhanced by the fact that there is a Human Rights Act in the United Kingdom, and contrast that with what you could achieve or what the committee could achieve if there were no legislative Human Rights Act?
Thank you. I mean, it's a very, very good question. I think the reality is that when we make recommendations or respond to court judgments or look at bills, if we didn't have the teeth of the Human Rights Act potentially chomping away at the back of the government lawyers and civil servants' mind when they're reading our reports, we would be taken much less seriously. So I think the first answer is that having a Human Rights Act which gives effect to these standards is extremely important. And in fact, we get much more thorough responses from the government in relation to convention rights than we do in relation to the other human rights which we also scrutinise for compliance with. I think it's also very important that the courts are there in the background, or in the foreground sometimes, but I think that also gives an edge to our work, particularly because we have forced Parliament to take notice of court judgments about human rights and forced them to consider what Parliament should do and what the government should be doing in response. And that work we are increasingly integrating with our other work. So in a bill we might recommend it be amended to give effect to a judgment, for example. So I think that's another important... I mean, without that hard-edged fact in the sort of universe as well, I think that the committee will be much, much less effective.
I didn't mean to cut off your opportunity to ask a question, but if it's long, I'm going to have to say I think we're out of time. If it's short, could I invite you to put it?
Yes, I'd just like to ask a question in terms of how robust do you believe this system is with the change of government?
Not at all. If an incoming government wanted to abolish the committee, it could effectively do so. It could repeal the Human Rights Act. It could simply not reappoint the committee at the start of the new parliament. And that's all sort of uncharted territory. I mean, it's not that straightforward necessarily, because it being a joint committee, it's possible that the House of Lords might appoint its members to the committee if there wasn't such a clear government majority in the Lords wishing that outcome, which would then force the issue within Parliament. But you're then all into the territory of Parliament's sort of self-governing arrangements and setting up its own committees and so on, and that's all, that would all have to be played out after an election with the normal horse trading that goes on between the political parties. But you're absolutely right. I mean, it's not secure in any way. But I'm not sure one can legislate for parliamentary committees. That's a thought to leave everybody with. Does the Victorian Charter, has that got a provision establishing the committee? It does. Right. Well, in Westminster, it wouldn't be possible. It'd be regarded as a matter for Parliament to regulate itself.
Thank you very much. Now, could I just close by first thanking everybody who came? Human Rights Commission greatly appreciates the interest you show in these very important topics for Australia, and we're delighted to have everybody here. But could I especially thank Murray for what was a wonderful presentation, enormous introduction to the process that we're engaging on, to give us this concrete information about what's happened in a comparable jurisdiction with similar values and parliamentary processes to our own. It was wonderful to have you, Murray. Thank you so much for the time you've taken both to prepare and to be with us today. Thank you.